and friends. I'm Val.
I'm Courtney.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is My Perfect Romance.
Bow, chicka, bow, bow.
What about all of you?
Or how about my sweet love?
I think we all have a different idea about what romance is.
Well, what is the perfect romance?
Gosh, I don't know, but let's find out.
Hello, we're very lucky today to have Gerald Everett Jones with us, and we are going to be doing a quick little interview with him about his book, Harry Hornby's Kenya Sundowner. And Gerald Everett Jones lives in Santa Monica, and this is his 11th novel, and he has won multiple awards in literary fiction. Just before this book's publication, he returned from living 2 years in Kenya, supporting his wife George's work in wildlife conservation and child welfare. He is a board member of the Independent Writers of Southern California, a Film Independent Fellow, and a winner of the Writers Guild of America Diversity Award. He holds a Bachelor of Arts with honors from the College of Letters, Wesleyan University, where he studied under novelist Peter Boynton, F.D. Revie, and Jerry Kosinski. And I have to apologize for mispronouncing some of those names, but we're very honored to have him with us here today. Yes, we loved your novel, so thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, we all...
Well, thank you. That was very kind. Jerzy Kosinski can't really object because he's not with us anymore. He was the famous fellow who wrote Being There and The Painted Bird. And it was interesting because, you know, part of the whole story of his life is, which presumably The Painted Bird was somewhat autobiographical, but he claimed to have been a war orphan in Europe, and then the Russian troops picked him up and they took him to Moscow as an orphan and college educated him, whatever. But one of the most interesting things he said was, the only moment of true freedom he ever had was suspended by an airplane between the two cooperatives. And they said, well, why are you here? And he said, well, there's mountaintops here.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. What a great person to know.
Oh, absolutely.
It was a course in Camus and Sartre, and so it was a lot about rather cynical worldview, make it up as you go along. So,
well, that's interesting because in your novel, there was a lot of suspense and a lot of political aspects and things looking at it. But I love how you still had such a positive tone for the main character and you kept the main character so loving and open. So that's...
Well, you know, Harry Hornby, Harry Gardner, he gets the Kenyan nickname Hornby, and we can talk about why that was, but he's something of a couch potato and a fairly well-meaning guy. And, you know, here he is, he's widowed, he's in Los Angeles, and, you know, he's got nothing to do but play golf and bridge, and he doesn't want to do either one. And he doesn't like getting set up on dates. And so this is a bit like White Lotus in that this tour packager, if you will, there are these people, comes to him and says, you know, I can really show you a good time in East Africa. And the implication is, you know, he's going to have hookups and drunken parties. And there are tours like that, and perhaps even more notoriously in Thailand. Yes. I did not, when I lived there, I did not see quite that lifestyle. Mm. What I saw was mixed race couples that the German fellow, middle-aged fellow, maybe would fly down every summer and he'd spend 3 weeks with the same woman every year. But I'd see them walking down the street with her little boy and okay, fine. But then also I would see the middle-aged British lady and she introduces the young fellow as, oh, this is my bodyguard and my driver. Okay, fine. But how come I saw you scamming in the pool last night? So there was a lot of that. I mean, certainly if you went to the if you went to the rock clubs, you know, the nightclubs, mm-hmm. sure, there's going to be bar girls, and that's true whether you're in Istanbul or Singapore or mm-hmm. anywhere. But in Kenya, it was interesting because it was really a very mixed race society in that. And before I left, I had been told, okay, Kenya is mostly English speaking and Christian. And I thought, okay, I kind of know the history of colonialism. I'm going to assume that these people are either Anglican because British or Catholic because they're German. And no, most of the Kenyans are Pentecostal. And they're just jumping up and down evangelicals. And it's because missionaries are still welcome to this day because they will set up schools that the government doesn't have to pay for.
Right. There's a lot of charitable work that goes on.
I learned so much.
The economy going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole notion of philanthropies. Yes. The philanthropies are quite widespread and they're multinational, multi-denominational and all that kind of thing. But also Kenyans regard them as employment opportunities. I mean, it's a job, and it's not like they're now that there will be a difference in the area of wildlife conservation where, you know, my wife was working in that to some extent, mm-hmm. and the people who volunteer for Kenyan Wildlife Service, the people who volunteer for philanthropic wildlife rescue organizations, David Sheldrick's Trust, and some of those places, Colobus Monkey. Those people typically are volunteers, but you can't volunteer as a tourist. You have to have a work visa to volunteer because the government seems to think, well, that's a way for an intern to eventually get a job. And that could be true. So, I mean,
they want to reserve the jobs for the locals.
Well, I mean, and actually, my wife, we had an official employment contract with the orphanage. It was something of an orphanage school, unwed mothers that she was teaching at, language skills and also environmental wildlife conservation. And she, in her employment application, she had to list the names of the five Kenyans she would be training after her contract was up.
Had that in the novel, and I found that so interesting.
Yeah.
And that was literally true. I mean, I was saying, okay, literary fiction, yes, it's fictionalized memoir, but I'm not going to tell you which parts are true.
You can keep it that way. So when your publicist reached out to us initially, and she and I were chatting, she was telling me about like that kind of racy side of Kenya and like this, I don't know, it almost felt like there could be a lot of sex trafficking going on. And I was a little bit nervous
There are rumors about some of that, but as I say, on a daily basis, I rarely saw anything that was suggestive of that.
Yeah.
But I would see these mixed race couples and sometimes they would be guests at the resort hotels, whatever, but you really didn't know whether they were husband and wife because there's really quite a few of those as well. So, and also you've got quite a few Indian Kenyans going back a couple of generations. There are many Kenyan born ethnic people from India, and that's actually considered the 44th tribe of Kenya. I mean, there's 43 what used to be called tribes. Now they're called, the anthropologists call them ethnic societies. Somebody should tell the cab drivers that. But Kenya became independent from Britain in 1963 after some strife. And the Mau Mau Rebellion being among those troubles, if you will. And three basic rich families have ruled the country since then. And one of them that's at the top is the Kikuyus, which is the ethnicity of Obama's father. And the Kikuyus were the ones that befriended the Brits at the really the peak of the empire there, which was right around the turn of the century, right before World War One. And so the Kikuyu probably had more British school education, more language skills, certainly had maybe a bit more employment and income than some of the other tribes. And so, yes, Kikuyu is perhaps considered Aristo of Kenya. But one of the things that struck me is that as a white person from the United States going to Africa, I thought, okay, well, colonialism, whatever, I'm going to be the nasty white guy who's going there to tell them what to do. And I felt like, I guess I know how Bill Gates might be treated. It was like, here's a wealthy American, what would you, how much would you want to spend? You're either investing in business or you're a tourist and you want the best wine and food that you can find. And you're going to find, just incredible gourmet cooking up and down the resort coast. I mean, a lot of these chefs were actually trained in India. So, you're going to get long buffet tables full of just the most amazing vegetarian food too. I mean, these wonderful dishes. So yes. And white linen tablecloths and sterling silver and waiters in black tie. And you can't get that service in Britain these days.
Well, okay. I'm convinced I might want to go there.
So it's really, kind of Gilded Age old school in a way. And it's funny because you even learn how probably Teddy Roosevelt did it back in the day when he was on safari, because there are tent camps. But when you're invited to breakfast in the tent camp, you show up and it's at Creekside and white linen tablecloths and waiters in black ties.
Goodness.
And I believe it's in the book about the crocodiles, about the crocodiles at cocktail time.
I don't think so.
There's one place that
when they went on safari,
because we went even before Georgia began teaching. One of the reasons that we went back and forth to Africa many times was she was doing ecotourism reviews of these resorts and hotels, and so we would get comped and stay in a luxury suite, and that was wonderful. Well, one place we were staying the first evening, and we were shown to the community room and the dining room, and they said, well, why don't you have a drink at Creekside first? And so they showed you out to this patio, and there was a wooden railing, and you look over the railing, and there must have been a dozen big crocodiles.
Oh my goodness!
5 feet away, and the thing was that you could tell that they were kind of perched on an angle, and they said, oh yes, the banks are created at a certain angle so that they can't get up this high. it was right about 5:30 p.m. something like that, cocktail hour, and they said, well, just wait a moment. And I said, well, what for? And they said, just wait a moment. And so right on the dot, a fellow comes out of the kitchen and he's got this big pot, and he tosses these leftover bones over the railing at these crocodiles. All these guys woke up at the same time. It was snack time. This was dog treats for the crocodiles.
That would have been terrifying.
So fortunately, nobody fell over the railing. We didn't lose anybody that night.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You kind of touched on
the other thing that happens routinely, and I know this is in the book, is if you're dumb enough to to have a basket of rolls on the table, you'll just say, what was that? I think it was a monkey. Oh, where are the rolls?
Yeah, in your book, they snuck into the hotel room.
And that was so cute.
Yeah. No, common as squirrels. I mean, it's just, and we had our two terriers with us, and they had enormous fun with the monkeys. Now, you would not want to have fun with a baboon, because that's like encountering a wild wolf here. I mean, baboon is a little bit too powerful and might just want your food and not to eat you. But in the process, if you're in the way, then that could be a problem. So, Yeah, no, it's a fascinating place to be. And that episode that I put in there about the safari.
Yes.
You know, Harry's something of a couch potato, and his friend says, "Well, no, why don't we just, you know, divert ourselves? We're on our way to Nairobi. Let's go on a safari." That's a true episode, and it was really quite grisly. I won't relate that spoiler. But Harry decides based on that he doesn't really want to go on any more safaris, and this is why I would say, as a free tip to tourists. I would not plan on going on safari with children. And it's not because there's any danger to them. But it's not going to be... See, when they do these documentaries for Nat Geo, it's like any romance movie. They show the clips that turn out okay in the end.
Yeah.
You know, the baby elephant survives the drought. But, you know, if you're going to go on safari, you're going to see the real deal. And the adult people on safari very much want to see the gory stuff. I mean, they're, you know, it's like people going to, you know, show of some kind.
Gladiator-esque.
Well, yes, exactly. And the drivers are all in communication with each other on their cell phones. Everybody has a cell phone. Because that's their checkbook as well. The cell phone's a checkbook because they had Zelle way before we did. Safaricom, but they're in constant contact with their fellow drivers, and so since everybody wants to see lions or elephants, mainly those two, perhaps giraffe, they will save the big sighting of any of the so-called big five until the end of the tour. But the thing is, they'll coordinate among themselves because they don't want any more than about four trucks near anything that's happening at a time, because otherwise it's just a big gawkers, you know, traffic block, and the preserve wildlife folks are not particularly thrilled about, because it can intimidate the, you know, you can't go any closer. You can't get out of the truck, period. Yeah. But I mean,
I liked how in the book that you pointed out that there's, you knew which tribe you were on good terms with and who was friends with who based upon who got the calls on the big five spottings when people were on safari.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because you see the drivers will speak the foreign language of the tourists. I mean, if they know they're getting German tourists, they'll pick some driver that speaks German. But okay, in our case, it'd be an English language driver, and also everybody pretty much speaks Swahili. But then also there'll be a third tribal language that maybe only a few people in the park speak. And so the drivers will be talking to each other in that language so that the others who might be eavesdropping on the walkie-talkie system won't know where the lions are, so that they can get the big tips from their people. Yeah. So yeah, there's that stuff that goes on.
I love that you, Harry makes a remark about watching an animal die, and he says it changed the way he would see the world and his place in it. And did you see something like that and feel like you said you did go on that safari? Did you?
Well, I saw
the gazelle,
three female cheetahs, attacking wildebeest herd. And I won't go into any more detail than that, but that's the episode that makes Harry feel as though he's kind of seen enough of this.
I really bonded with Harry on his response to witnessing that, and just how delicately you described the mother's eyes. That crushed me. I was right with Harry on that.
I suppose I was hypersensitive to this because, see, my wife Georgia, besides being a wildlife activist, she's a vegan, and when she come back here to Santa Monica, since we moved back, I mean, she is founding another charity in Kenya called the Elephant Matriarch Project. And that's mm-hmm. about environmentalism, but it's also about education for young teen females. And the people who are involved with that tend to be both wildlife activists or animal activists and vegans. So, I mean, it's something of a posse, if you will. I mean, especially in Los Angeles.
Is this how it changed your view of the world and what you wanted to do about, you know, your part in animals and playing a part in there?
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, you realize also that's the natural order of things. I mean, but that's easy to say, but when you realize that's what it is, it was interesting because, again, I report in the book, you know, how, you know, you go to the vegetable market and you'll hear from everybody, you know, Kenyans and expats alike, corruption is the mother of Kenya. And it's like a national motto practically. I mean, yeah. Nobody's making any secret of it. And everybody wants to gossip about it. But there was one of the past presidents of Kenya who had a big grant for a public works project that just disappeared. And it was well known that it was acknowledged that it had gone into his own pocket. And his response was, "It is our time to feed."
Yeah.
Now, that sounds
selfish,
chauvinist, corrupt, gangland, yeah. whatever. Yeah. But actually, the people of Kenya will hear that a different way. Mm-hmm. Because during the wildlife migration, which is just about this time of year, where it's all these animals going across the Serengeti, so they're going from the place where the water's dried out to the, you know, hope to find, you know, some other grazing land, and you know, it's a migration of millions of animals. Okay, well, the Kenyans' point of view about the great migration is it's the lion's time to feed.
Oh, you know, this is their
right. Okay, because most of the year those lions are borderline starving.
Okay? Yeah. I mean,
if the female lion is the one that hunts, and again, it's just it's just like the patriarchal Kenyans. It's like, you know, the guy sits back and waits for the, you know, the wife to bring the meal home, and the you know, she and her girlfriends, right? Because they hunt in the and so, but the those big cats of all breeds are starving much of the year. Okay, they are lucky to find, let's say, a wounded gazelle or a baby something that has been somehow separated from its herd. So that statement had a lot more meat. I mean, everybody's heard that quotation. It's like George Washington, "I shall not tell a lie," kind of quotation. But yeah, I mean, it really does have a double meaning.
Yeah, they understood that. I felt like one of my favorite things about your book was that sense of corruption.
Yes.
You say that, you know, corruption is the mother of Kenya. And that's what kept me turning the page after page after page. So I have to know, because I think the most beautiful thing you did about this book is left to the very end where you finally kind of understood
yes.
what was behind their relationship that whole time. Because I kept just thinking how corrupt Aldo and Esther were
Me
the whole
too.
Time. So
Me too.
When you wrote this book, did you start with the ending and then work toward it? Or did you surprise yourself?
And well, not at all. I delight in surprising myself. I used to write the outline. I mean, back in the day, I mean, I trained on, you know, writing business and technical books, and I wrote them for major publishers. But as I got into writing fiction, my early novels were screenplays that hadn't been sold. So I had an outline right there. But then I actually got to the point where I began to delight in the idea of writing from a blank page and kind of figuring out from one plot point, one beat, one scene to the next, just how it was going to unfold. I mean, I always had a sense of where I kind of wanted it to end up, but I never wanted to really be too focused on that, because the problem is you're going to miss some zigging and zagging that might be very, one of the most valuable things that I ever heard from another writer was Dan Brown in his masterclass say, the way to keep people turning the page is to keep making promises. And I was very surprised to hear him say that, because I thought in his masterclass, I was going to find out how to write a chase scene, or how to get people out of a, you know, closed room that's filling with water. I mean, that, you know, he does stuff like that. But his point was much more basic, is that every time you create a question in the reader's mind, which you should be doing deliberately, hopefully they're reading between the lines, so you don't, you know, plant it in their mind, you know, that everybody wants to kind of figure it out for themselves. That's part of the entertainment.
I love that foreshadowing, because you kept leaving these questions that I was feeling anxious about. I thought it was going
to be anxiety is what is going to make you turn the page, because you go, I'd love to put this book down and get my pajamas on, but I really want to find out. It's the old page turner thing. But but also I will say that, I mean, there are these crass tricks that, you know, and you learn all of them in screenwriting class. The screenwriters were the best craftsmen in terms of being able to, you know, churn stuff out, because they had to. But one of the things that you learn is what they call backward integration. And that is, okay, if I end up deciding that my ultimate scene is going to be a shootout, then, and if my hero carries the day, I'm going to have to show him on the practice range in the first act. Okay. You know, I'm going to have to give him some familiarity with, a colleague of mine once said, it's because of Ian Fleming, who understood how much readers love detail, that all of his readers know what a Walther PPK is. I mean, this detail, people love detail. And that's another thing that editors sometimes try to wring out of writers. It's like, why do they need to know that? They don't necessarily need to know that. But the problem is, there's five things on the desk, and only one of them is going to be the letter opener that killed Mr. Green in the, you know, in the dining
room. In the library.
So you, that's part of the fun. I mean, John Le Carre is just an absolute master at this. And he refers to the operatives in his spy novels as close observers. And, you know, he talks about George Smiley. He's, after a hard day at work at MI6, he's trundling his way home in Chelsea. And when he gets to his front door, he can tell you the numbers of the license plates of every car that he passed on the street. Well, this is just this junkyard mind that, you know, poor George Smiley has. And, you know, he's a couch potato like Harry, but he's a brilliant thinker. And one of the things about George Smiley, and one of the things about Harry Gardner, is they're both overthinkers. They're both chronic overthinkers. It's like, why did he do that? Or how, you know, here's this woman in line at the grocery store, and she's got a t-shirt and jeans, but she's carrying a Vuitton bag. What's up with that? I mean, again, you know, it's just this disconnection of the stuff that, you know, adding that detail. And I was talking with a writer the other day about, like other masterful writers I've seen, when he had dialogue between two people, he never did the he said, she said, Gerald said, Lisa said, you know, any of that. And I've seen Paul Auster do that. Okay. It drives me friggin' nuts. Okay. I don't, as a reader, I lose track. And if there's three people on the scene, you know, it really is not, and they'll tell a film director, the hardest thing there is to shoot is a dinner table scene, because you've got different people speaking, you've got a different camera set up for each one. I mean, it'll drive you nuts in the editing room. Well, with the speaking, I was telling this writer colleague, I said, because it was his first book, and I said, listen, I would appreciate it as a reader if you would attribute not every speech, but every now and then, let me know who, find a way to let me know who's speaking. And I'm not just saying Gerald said Lisa said. I'm saying with the quote, have it, Clint walked over to the bar, slammed his drink down, turned around and insisted, comma, and then here's the quote. Now, what that does is, and again, we're talking screenwriting. it's not screening anymore. Well, it is. It's acting. It's
the
theater
best
acting.
Dialogue is.
You're giving the actor business, and that business can actually be part of the plot. But it also puts the reader in a real environment, whereas it's not just dialogue. The characters are doing something. Maybe they're playing a card game, and this guy's staring at that guy, and I mean, you know, again, we're back to Casino Royale
yeah. I think it also makes all of your characters very rich.
That it gives you a perspective. It gives you a perspective on who the character is and what their emotional state is, because you can't be in everybody's head, or you might choose to be, but that is something of a more old-fashioned way of doing things. So the idea that he laid his cards down slowly, or he laid his cards down slowly and he pushed his way, himself away from the table with a smirk. I mean, you know, this guy didn't have any good cards.
Oh, no.
He's going to go get a drink. Mm-hmm. I mean, and he's either not a very good card player or he's a bluffer on the next hand. I mean, it just gives you so much more storytelling. And a director that I once worked with said, I'll never tell an actor, go back, you know, on your exit, after your exit, go back in the room. What I'm going to tell them is, okay, on your exit, remember you just forgot your car keys and go back for them. Okay. And so he's giving the actor a reality, not a stage direction. He's giving them business. He's giving them, that's part of their life is, okay, is he always forgetful about his keys? Or you know, I mean, again, that gives you material for maybe later of, you know, the next time he forgot his phone, the next time he forgot his wallet, you know, it gives you stuff to work with. So it makes it seem very, very real. And, you know, we've got that opening scene in the book where Harry is waiting for Esther, who he's only known for a couple of days, but he kind of likes her. I mean, we're really talking about a second chance romance kind of book here, right? And, you know, who knew? I mean, he thought he'd be hooking up with hotties. He didn't want that at all once they came on to him. So here's this middle-aged lady, but I mean, she's pretty attractive. And, you know, he thought he was going to run into her at the Tiki Lounge that night. Well, you know, here's all this business about, they've been calling him Harry Harambee. He doesn't know why. And it's a nickname. So, you know, he's having his third beer and he pulls out a banknote and it goes, look, Harambee's printed on the banknote. And it's like, what does that mean?
So what exactly does that Harambee mean on the back of that banknote?
Well, he's sitting there in the Tiki Lounge and he's waiting for, he thinks he's going to hook up with his friend Aldo, who's the tour packager who got him there. But he's also aware that he thought he was going to see this Esther Mwemba who he'd encountered before, but he hasn't really run into her in that small town. And, you know, he's thinking that they could have a thing. They might not have a thing, but he'd loaned her some money. And it was like, am I being taken or taken advantage of? And then of course the next thought is, do I care?
Yeah.
which is a big theme of the book, which is, you know, if I'm having a good time, do I really care?
Yeah.
So here he is at the bar and, you know, Aldo's not showing up. She's not showing up, or she hasn't shown up yet. She will show up. But he takes out this banknote
And he happens to see that Harambe is listed underneath the is shown underneath the crest, the official crest of Kenya, which is two rampant lions around a shield. And Harambe means basically the same thing, e pluribus unum, you know, one from many.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he kind of wonders, well, how come she keeps calling me Harry Harambe, or just Harambe, you know, Gardner is my name, but what's this Harambe all about? And they sometimes chuckle, you know, when they say this. It's like, wait a minute. And he begins to realize that maybe it just has to do with they're thinking, okay, their money's in my pocket, I just don't know it yet.
Oh, yeah.
And,
there was definitely that.
And the fascinating thing about this, and I think there's something, it's a bit more of a sober thought, but actually after I had written the book, I was doing, you know, I do read the Kenyan newspapers, and I also have read some histories of that particular part of Kenya, because that mostly Arab coast, which was owned by the Sultan of Zanzibar, wasn't really turned over until officially until the independence in 1963, when the British kind of, you know, got out of there. And one of the things that's happened is that, yes, Harambe was a spirited slogan of the independence movement. And, you know, even though we're 43 tribes, we're going to, you know, we're all one. And you will have people in Kenya who say, we are one. I mean, they do look at you fine. And they even say that to, you know, expats and visitors and whatever. But very new age, right?
Yeah.
But the thing about Harambe is I didn't realize that the meaning of that word to Kenyans has really evolved quite a bit since that time. Because Harambe, because of the way the parliamentary political system continued, you know, it was basically the British parliamentary system continued after independence, the politicians, especially the cabinet members and the representatives in parliament, would periodically do these town halls. So they'd travel the country, you know, they'd be, you know, Q&A with the residents, whatever. But actually, these were mostly fundraising events. So Harambe meant fundraiser.
Okay. Oh.
So that had in the beginning, that had kind of a popular ring. It's like, okay, you know, this is how, you know, the people support their government, whatever. Yes, we have taxes, but we also have Harambes and we give enthusiastically the people we want to support, whatever. Well, during these Harambe sessions, the politicians increasingly, it was pretty clear they had their hand out for whatever it is that you wanted them to do. Now, does this sound familiar?
Yes.
And so Harambe became a synonym for corruption in Kenya.
Oh.
And so this whole notion of how do I deal with corruption is, I think, a very fundamental theme of the book.
Absolutely.
In that Harry is trying to decide, am I a tourist or am I a citizen?
Yes.
If I'm about to go home, or if I'm not committing to be here, then okay, maybe the reason is I want to stay with Esther. Okay, and this is, you know, this is going through his mind over and over again throughout the book of what does she mean to me? What do I mean to her? Why is she interested in me? I know why I'm interested in her, but she's got these two kids from another marriage, and she hasn't really told me about that. And, but, you know, he's supposedly dead, but it turns out that there's some other people in the mix. So this whole idea of, again,
where
am I being taken advantage of?
Yeah.
Or, and if the answer is yes, do I mind? And that also extends to this notion of philanthropy, where one of the things that's striking about East Africa in general is that philanthropies are more or less notorious for being money launderers. Not all of them, but it's certainly in the back of everybody's mind that this might be the case. But to a Kenyan, a philanthropy is an employer. A good example is there have been some academic studies been done about the economics of that that coastline there, the south coast of Kenya. And it has more private schools run by philanthropies than it has public schools. Mm-hmm. And one of the effects of that is the government still gives a pass to missionaries. Getting a visa, a missionary can get a visa in a week. It took me about a year and a half to get a resident card.
Oh, okay? Wow.
And this is because they'll cut right through the paperwork, because the thing is, if you're going to open a private school, it means we don't have to use tax money to open a public school.
Yeah.
And so what they'll do is they'll award scholarships to some local people as kind of a gesture to the community, so that they kind of, I won't say, you know, conned into the idea that this is in place of a public school. But in fact, the school's being supported by, you know, the private money. And where this was really obvious was in Nyeri, which we visited. We had a friend there who was a librarian in a private school. And it turned out I was hanging out in the lobby of that private school. And I knew very well that it was right down the street from the Coca-Cola factory, the Coca-Cola bottling plant. And there were plaques in the lobby. It's like, oh, the school from the generous donations of Coca-Cola. Well, Coca-Cola didn't open that school because it was a public-spirited gesture. It's because their managers they couldn't get anybody to move there as an expat if there wasn't a good place for their kids to go to school. And so here are all these, you know, white kids running around in, you know, cardigan sweaters and plaid skirts.
Oh wow!
And great for the Kenyans that, you know, could pass the exams and get in. It's, you know, like a college in a way. Mm. And, you know, of course you'd have a fast track. I mean, we met and became friends with one of the local wildlife activists who actually ended up with a county government job. And I think of her actually as the Winnie Karu. I think of her as the Hillary Clinton of the future Kenya, perhaps. But I mean, she, you know, she let it be known her son goes to Princeton. So I mean,
So Gerald, it really sounds like Harry's journey of trying to decide where do I fit into Kenya is one that you shared yourself.
And I did. And the whole question of am mm-hmm. I a tourist or am I a citizen? You know, when I followed Georgette Africa, and you know, we found we leased the top floor room in a residential hotel. We actually had three bedrooms, and we had a swimming pool, and we had a staff, and it was half block from the ocean. I mean, it was really quite incredible. I actually thought we were retiring there. I thought this was, you know, we're not going to go back. And about 2 years into it, as I say, it became the onset of COVID, although we weren't really appreciate that at the time. But also her employment contract was up for renewal, and it wasn't particularly clear what her status was. Mm. Because as I say, she was supposed to list the people she was supposed to train and the Kenyans she was supposed to train to replace her. That typically is a paperwork kind of thing. And, you know, if her talents are needed, you know, she'll be renewed. And, you have to be seen as kind of irreplaceable. But, I mean, you know, she was really beloved by she had about 20, 30 students there. And, you know, she would take them on field trips. They'd never seen elephants before. She would take them out to see the elephants. They'd never been to a restaurant. So she took them to the restaurant and in one of these luxury resorts, and they all sat down, and that must have been quite a sight. I was not there for that session, but you know, she's got the video of them doing the dance and singing for her after they got back. I mean, it's really kind of a hoot. So, but she decided that it wasn't. I mean, her main objective in going there originally was wildlife conservation, and mm-hmm. because the government was tightening up on work visas for that. Especially if you were an expat, they were much more interested in having Kenyans join the Kenyan Wildlife Service. She didn't hope for employment, direct employment with the government for that, but she did hope for employment with the affiliated organizations like the philanthropies that work hand in hand with KWS. And KWS, for example, they've had a really, I mean, number one, trophy hunting is illegal in Kenya.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. And one of the things that the KWS does that really is an incredibly positive thing toward wildlife conservation is, the population of lions is really dwindling along with other animals, but lions in particular, because number one, yes, of course, the trophy hunters all want them, but also, especially in the Maasai regions where the cattle herders are, the Maasai boys are part of their bar mitzvah-like trial, is they're supposed to go out and chase a lion down with a stick to show how brave they are. You know, Maasai have a reputation of being pretty fierce, defenders. So, but what happens on a Maasai farm is if a lion happens to kill a head of cattle, you don't send the boys out to hunt the lion down as you would in the old days. And typically they would use spears. And you get on your cell phone, you call Kenyan Wildlife Service, and they show up pretty speedily, and they go, yes, this is a lion carcass. Here's your check for $400, which is what it would have brought, at the slaughterhouse. So then they take the carcass away, and they've saved a lion. So this has actually contributed to, and they have similar plans toward. They actually track. They try to give elephants names, the ones that they've seen, and their identifying characteristics, and they have logs of how often they see them. And for rhinos, they have the rhinos actually wearing these RFID tags, like the chips that the dogs have. And they know where every rhino is pretty much all the time. So. It's amazing, man. And the populace really needs to understand that the tourists aren't going to come here if there aren't any animals left. But also, you've got an expanding population, and one of the things that happens very often is that you got a brand new farm that somebody staked out in a protected area, which is not part of a national park, but it's still a protected area by let's say a tribe, but they've been granted this farmland. So here they are putting a corn crop, and it turns out it's right in the middle of the route that the elephants take to water. Okay, so the elephants are going to trample right through there, mm-hmm. and they're probably going to eat whatever they can find on the way, and they're likely to get shot or speared or poisoned. And, this whole process of what they would call animal conflict is really the core problem in terms of wildlife conservation.
Yeah. That makes sense.
And the other thing that I learned that was really kind of stunning is that there was one of the churches that George and I had attended here in L.A., and they had this whole philanthropic program of, we're going to put boreholes, meaning wells, we're going to put new wells, in East Africa, because these women are hiking miles and miles to get water, and that sounds like an awfully righteous thing to do. But the thing is, if you don't do it, what it would amount to an environmental impact report, then you may put the water hole in a place that the elephants, are going to do some damage on their way to it.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
absolutely.
And you know, again, the people who drill the wells are just simply looking for a contract. They're going to like, they're going
to
just
do it wherever you tell us to do it.
Yeah. It's like with anything, it depends upon how conscientious they are. And
well, and you can just things we don't deal with here in the United States.
It's true. But you can see how that Harambe kind of comes into everything where, you know, you have that whole sense of oneness, but then you also have what you said, that corruption that kind of comes into it and how it all plays together.
So when I was thinking Harambe, because it was presented initially as like unity. And when I think of unity, I think of like, you know, two people becoming one, or as Kenya views it, like multiple tribes becoming one. And so I thought it was interesting because he had a couple different relationships in this book. One of them with Esther, who we've talked a lot about, but the other one was with Veronica, who is one of my favorite characters because she was somebody who didn't beat around the bush. She said things exactly as they were.
Yes.
And she, towards the end, and she really made Harry think. She said something about how love is transactional, and she, you know, proposed that they have a transactional companionship. Can you expand a little bit more about kind of how that idea came about, that character?
Well, you know, his first impression of her is, you know, she's a British aristo snot.
Yes.
And, you know, and she's an attractive middle-aged lady
press who's kind of been there
and done that, and probably, you know, and she might have been married a few times, and she might have had, you know, a couple of handfuls of attractive male lovers. I mean, she's a very self-confident and well-educated woman, and she's employed by, you know, the United Nations. And we did run across quite a few professionals from UNICEF and from some of their other programs. And one of the things that really struck me, and this was more of a real life, this person was not a real analog of Veronica, but it really did ground me in the type of work that she did, is that this friend that we had, who was also in wildlife conservation, she was an attorney from France, and actually her expertise was in government electioneering.
In
local political promotion, and she was actually under contract to the UN. There was a and it was a cooperative program with, I believe, a U.S. philanthropy that was giving them quite a few million to do this. But the idea was she was supposed to make connections and build relationships inside national governments of the countries in East Africa. And then she was supposed to identify up-and-coming female candidates for politicians and fund and promote their campaigns. And
so
one
of
the things that her job, because actually I helped her with her report, was that she was tracking metrics. She was going around collecting, you know, demographics and voter turnout and, you know, ad expenditures. And, you know, she had all these metrics that she was sending back. And that's why I have Veronica kind of educating Harry about, you know, if you're going to have if you're going to start this philanthropy that Esther, you know, is encouraging you to do, you have to understand that you're never going to get big bucks from anybody if you don't have a business plan and formal processes for collecting metrics, because it's not just that they go, "Well, this is a great idea. Here's $5 million." No, they want to know, okay, if you're educating these women, what happens after you've graduated from the program? You're training them to be seamstresses or hairdressers or weavers, They're going back to their villages. Did you give them any business, any entrepreneurial skills? Are they going to know how to render a bill to somebody? Well, are they going to know how to keep a set of books? And so then you've got to track them and say, well, how successful has this person been? Or are they simply going to be so unskilled that they lapse into prostitution?
And I like how with Veronica's character, you kind of have her helping Harry understand that even about Kenya relationships too. You know, she always kind of pulls it back in. She's very straightforward with him. And I like how her character gave him some grounding when he really needed it.
Yeah, she was the only one that did that for him.
Yeah, and I think that also, her grounding gave him a lot of tools and foundation he needed in order to make decisions about his relationship with Esther as well, because I think that her kind of level-headedness and don't read too much into it, don't get into your head too much, and this is kind of how culture works here, really helped Harry kind of come to his resolutions in the end. So do you feel like the transactional elements that Veronica brought forth were important for Harry's resolution and understanding in the end of the book? And we don't want to give away the end of the
for
book.
Sure. Yeah. For sure. For sure. And part of the whole, this whole idea of understanding what ulterior motives might exist, what profit seeking might be part of any initiative. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you've got, for example, the Chinese coming into Kenya to help them build highways. Well, you know, what they'll typically do is they'll loan the government the money for the highway construction contract. But then they want collateral, and you know the collateral for building the railway there was the control of most of the port of Mombasa, you know, which is the Baltimore of Kenya.
Oh, absolutely.
And so if the government defaulted, suddenly you've got the Chinese. Now, the Chinese did this in Sri Lanka already. And one of the things also that we heard on one of our travels was we were in Ecuador, and taxi driver we were driving around Quito, the capital, and the taxi driver was bragging about, you know, the brand new subway system which the Chinese had built, and then he laughed and he said, well, you realize we gave him as collateral the Galapagos Islands.
Oh, that is interesting.
And the we can get transactional and geopolitical here, because what I saw reported in no newspapers was that when Mike Pence visited Ecuador, he met with the president, and suddenly there was a big chunk of money, a loan to the may have even been a grant to Ecuador, and they basically bailed them out of the Chinese debt.
Oh.
And not so coincidentally, I would say, Julian Assange was kicked out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
All of the intrigue, all of this wealth of information, you incorporate it so well into your book. And I really love how you take us through this journey with Harry, because he's such a loving, acceptable guy, and he's in a position in his life where he can kind of roll with things. And I think it's so beautifully tied together. And I like how during this exploration and your incorporation of all of this wealth of information, we get to see Harry's character grow and develop and mature. You've done such a good job writing this book.
You have. We loved it.
Well, thank you. I do think that, you know, there is a different outlook, and I don't think it's all that uncommon in middle life and in later life. You know, when you're talking about the concept of second chance romance, it may have to do with, you know, if we were to move in with each other, you know, if we combine our social security checks, maybe we don't have to move, you know.
Yeah.
To you know, someplace where there's no taxes, or the I, you know, and yet that's not necessarily as dry and transactional as it would be just simply hooking up with a roommate. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
you might use an analogy like an arranged marriage is, you know, there's the statistics on arranged marriage and tradition and where it's traditionally done is, you know, there's an awful lot of loving relationships that grow from that, but it's not, doesn't necessarily happen, you know, the night of the honeymoon.
Yes. Mm-mm. Yeah, that's true. I've known some people who were part of arranged marriages, and it's always beautiful. I've been with them for, you know, over 20 years, and it's really glorious to kind of watch that relationship grow and build, because it is based off of a united beginning, and it kind of a set standard of operating principles and understandings.
Well, you know, we also have, you know, American movie culture where, you know, passion and whirlwind romance and, you know, love at mm-hmm. first sight and all these tropes. And, you know, certainly I've known couples that, you know, first I laid on eyes on her, I knew that we'd be together for the rest of our life. You know, that does exist. That
absolutely.
I mean, I have friends like that, but I mean, you know, my first wife decided that she couldn't really handle the fact that her son was suffering from schizophrenia, and that was like he was like the she built her life around him, and when it was pretty clear he wasn't going to recover, she just lost it. So
heartbreaking thing.
That would be so heartbreaking.
Things happen, you know. Life happens.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the old joke: if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
That's actually brilliant.
Too true.
Yeah.
Well, so the fact that Harry is open to whatever decisions might be presented to him, I think is very much to his credit.
Absolutely.
In the beginning, as part of his arc is, you know, he's the guy who sits in the back seat and doesn't say much and just stares out the window. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that may be a very wise way to visit a new culture, you know, is to absorb a lot before you start making a lot of, you know, I mean, I still think that, you know, buying property in Kenya could be incredibly risky because, you know, I'm not sure that the title, if there is such a thing as title insurance, I'm not sure that it's all that binding. And, you know, if some politician decides they want your house, they may just decide to come and...
Yeah, that would be... I would probably still be a little hesitant on that one.
No, we did hear stories about that, you know, there were... And usually these were, like, old-school expats, and especially, like, there were quite a few South Africans who had, like, second homes, and, you know, that we've just gone through a whole period where there's all this reverse... accusations of reverse sexism or racism with South Africans that, you know, they were being, you know, their farms were just simply being taken away from them.
Yeah.
And whatever. And I heard stories like that. I didn't know anybody that actually went through that, but I did hear that there was one fellow that he, you know, older Italian fellow whose villa was like confiscated. And there was a rumor that, well, it wasn't because of the back taxes. It was because somebody else coveted it, you know, mm-hmm. who had some political influence. Well, that's also a really complicated situation because that part of the country, north of Malindi, was kind of the Miami Beach for the Italian mafia for a while.
Oh, wow.
And so until the Kenyans chased them out. And the rumors I heard was, well, how come the mafia? The mafia had been those gangsters have been kind of chased out of Palermo, and you know the Italian government was like, you know,
bragging about the fact that, you know, they cleaned things up. Well, all these guys show up and, you know, they're opening casinos and resorts and whatever in Malindi. And, yeah. And well, how come the Italians left? And the answer that I got in the vegetable market was the Kenyan mob didn't want to share.
That makes sense. But, you know, even with all of this strife, I think that in your book, I think you kind of also, you do a really good job of balancing Harry's, you know, optimism and his willingness to kind of play things out with also his skepticism too. And I think, would you say that kind of the takeaway is to, you know, live life and be there, be present? Because I think your book is beautiful. I think it has a lot to offer people. And what would you say for you? What did you want readers to get from your book?
Well, I think that being, there's a difference between being idealistic and being naive.
Yes.
And we have this, and one of the things that I think came out for me in my travels, not only there, but elsewhere, other parts of the world, is, you know, this idea of American exceptionalism. Okay, yes, there's an awful lot about American history that is really, we could be really proud of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Berlin Airlift is a, you know, might be an example.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the main reason that the British were in places like Kenya and India, yes, of course. And again, it was two-sided. Yes, there was the corruption of, you know, we need their resources for our industry, our growing industries, the Industrial Revolution, all like that. But also, there was a really strong ethic in the British Empire of, you know, we're civilizing the world.
Yes.
Okay, and you know, when the British left India, they did leave in place a judicial system, a body of laws that exists to this day. Now, this doesn't mean that their motives were pure, but their motives also weren't 100% corrupt. I mean, they wouldn't have gone to some of the expense that they did. I mean, they stayed in Kenya long after the private concerns that went there to get the minerals early in the 20th century, long after those companies had decided it didn't pay. And so the British government took over the railroad construction project. And one of the things that's really fascinating is that the British Parliament abolished slavery throughout the British Empire, I want to say in the 1840s, something like that. I think it was under Disraeli. And, you know, that we had, we fought a war and had a difficult time, you know, with Reconstruction for, mm-hmm. you know, throughout the 1860s. Well, another thing that people don't really know is that a lot of the slave labor for sugarcane just simply moved to Cuba under the Spanish.
Oh.
So there were slaves in Cuba up until the early 1880s.
That's the sad. So kind of the dichotomy of life, there's goods and bads that come with everything, is sort of, I don't know. I just think you have a wealth of knowledge and a lot of information. And I really, truly invite everyone to pick up this book and just devour it, because it will keep the pages turning. You have always given us an element of suspension. You've always given us something to look forward to. And you do, you kind of, it's that, I think you said it best when you said that line of naivety versus optimism. And we struggle right there with Harry as he's exploring this. And then also he's dealing with his own, does my life have value? Do I have purpose now? Where am I at? You know, and I just love how you write that all together. So I really do invite everyone to go pick up this book. The website information is
GeraldEverett.com, right?
GeraldEverettJones.com.
Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. .com.
Everett with two T's.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm not Jerry Jones. I don't own the Gerald.
And we will also post a link on myperfectromance.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. And then on Substack, it's GeraldEverettJones.substack.com or at GeraldEverettJones. And that is the Thinking About Thinking blog.
Yeah. Yes. And you have a lot of options for readers, too, because you just have such a wealth of information. And I would love to read more of your books, and I'd love to hear all. You have so much research and so much heart and soul and personal experience that you put into everything you write, and it really shows. So I highly encourage people
and
to
read
this.
One other thing I wanted to point out, some people prefer audiobooks. Some people, I read it and I loved it. I think Valerie listened to it.
Mm-hmm. I did both. I read both. The first part and listened to the second part. It's really great.
Yes, so that's also an option. Is it on anything other than Audible?
Yes, the audiobook just came out, and it's available not only on Audible, but it's available on Google Play and Kobo and a lot of the other distributors. And this is the only one that I've narrated. And I had the Get Published Radio podcast for years. And, you know, they would introduce me as, here's our host, Gerald Everett Jones. He's got the answers because he's made all the mistakes himself. And that was really true. I was one of the early self-publishers in print on demand and also in ebooks. Mm-hmm. And I just thought to myself, okay, you know, my heart is so much bound up in this book, and it's such a sentimental favorite of mine. I'll just, you know, I'm a podcaster. I can narrate this.
Yes.
Well.
Oh, you did such a good job. I loved listening to you.
We've enjoyed talking to you.
You wouldn't believe how much was on the cutting room floor. Okay. It was quite a trial. It's 10 hours of narration, I believe. It's quite a bit. I'm proud of the result.
Yeah, it was a great time. Thank you so much,
Gerald. You have a wonderful day. And to our listeners, we really do encourage you to read this book. And thank you so much for tuning in.
Thank you.
You've been very kind, very generous with your time. And believe me, my heart's warmed by your reaction. And it's great to reach an audience, not just have fans, but know that you're, because I mean, I tell people, they said, well, what's your definition of success? I said, okay, it's not sales. It's not money. I mean, yes, I'd love to have all those things, but 100 years from now, if I could look down and see that somehow one of my books in a professor's syllabus, that's success.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's a lot to chew on in this book, and I think that this is one that could reach professor's syllabus in the future.
Absolutely. Yes. All right.
Hey, me and Dickens, yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm going to hit stop recording, but I think